Anybody need a sheet tonight? These are the questions we're going to go over. So by nature, this will be a little bit confrontational, but I feel like in our journey in life that there will be times where we need to stand up and be able to defend our faith, to be able to deal with issues as they come up. But I did what I feel like is give you a softball right off the bat. And so what we're first going to talk about is this premise or this dissenting view. How do you know that Moses was a prophet? What I mean by that is it's been preached from this pulpit here that you know that Moses is a prophet because of the Exodus. But Moses wrote Exodus. And so you can't prove yourself by the words that you wrote. So I don't think Moses is a prophet. So what do you say to that? Don't answer all at once. Moses wrote Exodus. If he's the author, how do you prove yourself by yourself?
Moses had followers who believed.
I mean, but cults have followers. Joseph Smith had followers. I mean, that's how do you prove yourself by yourself? I could proclaim that I'm the Messiah, write a book that I'm the Messiah and say, hey, look, this book says that I'm the Messiah. That's what I am. How do you prove yourself by yourself? How do you know that Moses was a prophet? Yes. And so that's where I think that is your first goal or step, is to find a common ground with somebody like me who is proclaiming such a thing. So yes, Mike, I think that's a good thing to look at Jesus. But let's take a step further back, because I think you can go back further, because I may not be a believer. So what would you appeal to as far as, if you're going to say Jesus is still in a book, so what would you appeal to as far as the Bible goes? The Bible is what? First and foremost, the Bible is? Before that. Yeah, I may not believe that the Bible is inspired by God, but there's one thing that everybody can agree on. It's a historical document. It is a historical document. So if I'm an atheist, I'm a non-believer, you can say, well, and you build off of this. So when we're talking about Moses as a prophet, you need to know where I stand. So if I'm an atheist, we're going to look at the idea that first, let's look at the Bible. You're talking about the Bible. Let's look at the Bible as a historical document. I can prove to you that this Bible dates back to the time that it says it does. We've got, and we've went over the evidences several times, but you know, the New Testament, there's over 58 complete or fragmented manuscripts in the Greek, over 10,000 Latin, over 9,300 in other ancient languages. We know these are copies, but you can date some of them all the way back. That's just the New Testament. So we can say that it's an inspired document. The dates for these manuscripts date back to 125 to the 15th century. You've got in the Old Testament, you've got the Dead Sea Scrolls that date back to pre-Christ. So when we're talking about Moses as a prophet and we want to use the Bible to say that he's, you know, a prophet, and you want to say Jesus, first you want to look at the idea that this Bible is a historical document. Now we need to talk about the story that's written there, which is what Mike's talking about, using Jesus. So if we're going to say Jesus said Moses was a prophet, what do we need to come to the conclusion about Jesus first, Mike? Jesus is who to us? He's the Son of God. The story, the Bible is written for us, but the story starts in the beginning. So there's a problem in chapter 3. The fulfillment or the resolution to that problem ultimately comes in the Gospels. And then we have what the new covenant is. But the idea is this story tells us that Jesus is the Messiah. I have historical documents dating back to the time of the story that this was written. Eyewitness believers, people who proclaimed it. I also have people who were there who didn't dissent. This Bible has stood the test of time. So if I'm going to say Moses is a prophet and I want to use Jesus to confirm that, we need to understand or at least build on whoever you're dealing with, whether I'm an atheist or I'm somebody else. If I believe in the Bible and that Jesus is the Christ, I must believe that Moses is a prophet because Jesus. Now, does Jesus believe that Moses is a prophet? Yes. How do you know, though?
About,
Yes. Okay, so Jesus quotes from the Old Testament. I look to Luke 24:44. Look over there real quick. Luke 24:44. There's a bunch of different places where he talks about, here's what Moses said in Matthew 19. Moses said you could not divorce your wife except for, or he allowed it to happen. But here in Luke 24:44, it says, now he said to them, these are my words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that all things which are written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled. All right? That's what he's talking about. You appeal to these things to show that I am who I say I am. Moses is one of those. He prophesied of the Messiah. And so when it was announced here, and that's kind of the framework for an idea of how we're going to converse and do this. But so now that I've said all those things, if we can say that Moses is a prophet because Christ said he was a prophet, we believe that Christ is the Son of God, what was it meant when it was said that Moses was a prophet because of the Exodus? How do you know that Moses was a prophet? Moses was a prophet because of the Exodus. What was meant in that comment? I twisted that comment. The miracles. Yes, so I twisted the comment that was made. The comment was meant as, you can know that Moses is a prophet because of the miracles that he was performing. I took it as the book. But you know because of the miracles that were performed. That's what Luke 24 is talking about. You are witnesses of these things, that he was raised from the dead, that repentance for the forgiveness of sins was being proclaimed, all those things. That makes sense when conversing or arguing with somebody. Did I show a valid way to show that Moses was a prophet? Yes, no, maybe. Evidences. The idea that this is a historical document. I took the shortcut. I just went straight to Jesus. He believes in the Son of God.
That's very good.
But that's kind of the idea. And I meant that to be a warm-up. I want you to converse with me. I want you to be combative with, I want you to deal with me like you would deal with somebody you're having a discussion with on these types of subjects. All right, so let's move on. Oh, yes, sir. Sorry. Joshua, most likely. This one. Yes, somebody else who was a witness to Moses and what happened. Go ahead, Mark.
I think transfiguration is another good one.
Okay. That he was transfigured? Okay. Just for me, and so this is also going to be something. This is a way that I thought about as to be able to prove that Moses was a prophet. There's more than one answer to that. And so, you know, just I took it from a logical standpoint. If we can work through that process. Yes, sir. Like what Grandpa was saying, that you've got people who witnessed this writing. It is a historical document. You just got to believe what was taught about it.
Just don't let them throw out the Exodus because they say what Moses wrote.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of why I started back in the evidence, is the fact that this is a historical document. And then, like I said, I took the end around with the idea that Christ, if we believe that Christ is the Son of God, then we know that Moses was, because if Christ wouldn't deceive us, he wouldn't deny us. And so if Christ believed he was a prophet and we believe he is the Son of God raised from the dead, then we know that he is. But yes, I agree with you that you don't have to give up the argument that it's a historical document. How do you know that he didn't write it? Oh, I completely agree. I completely agree. So this is ways that you can deal with questions that come up. Now, that was what I hoped to be a warm-up, and that lasted, you know, 15 minutes. So we'll see how this goes. Oh, I'm sorry, yes. If I'm an atheist, what I'm going to point to for Rocky and for you and for everything else, which ties back to evidence, is the fact that how do you know it was written in that time period? All these, I mean, you know, you're talking about a Hebrew writer, but how do I know that he was inspired? It was written then, but Moses lived, you know, 1,500 years before this manuscript was found. And so how do I know you believe that he's inspired and he talks about Moses, but if you point back to the Exodus or the foundation that Jesus is Christ, that you believe the story about Jesus. Who says Moses wasn't made up? Joseph Smith and the Mormons. Think about that for a second. You act like that's a weird chunk. Let me answer you. People act like that's a weird thing, but people write these stories and people believe them. Joseph Smith wrote this story and people believe the fact that he looked into a hat and saw some tablets and and you look at all the fallacies that go along with it. You think about the Quran and other stuff. People go along with these stories. It's easy to make stuff up. So I tie it back to the idea this is a historical document. And then I tie it to, I don't want to give up the idea that he was, it's a historical document. If you can prove it's a historical document, then why give up that he was the author? But also, if you think that the Bible is inspired, if you believe that Jesus is the Christ, that's the story here. That's what the Bible is here to tell us. If he is the Christ, then we can have faith and full confidence that he is a prophet because Jesus said so. I mean, that's the crux of our faith.
I didn't say that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
again, I tie it back to the idea that maybe somebody would say, because I think this would be the argument they would have. I can't talk to irrational thought necessarily, but the thought is that how do you know that the story is true? There has to be some type of faith there, or you need to be able to look, tie it directly back to the idea of it's a historical document that we can date back to the time that it was, you know, the person lived. And those would be the ways that I would go about it. I'm not saying this is the end-all be-all. Yes, sir?
Yeah, it seems like there's kind of two cases here. Does the book claim that Moses is a prophet? And the separate case is the book trustworthy?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I started back at evidences, and I think that's why it's very important for us to focus on evidences and to be able to teach our kids evidences. This is a historical document that we can rely upon. It can be dated back to the time, though it's copied, we can date it back to the time that it was written. And so I'm going to leave that there for now because we've still got a lot more to cover. I'm going to move on to a more trustworthy debate topic, instrumental music, because this is one I'm sure most people have had a conversation about. So on your paper, it should say, I believe instrumental music is okay in worship. And so I want to have a conversation about that. So what are your thoughts? Do you think that instrumental music is okay? Let's start there. Do you agree with the premise or do you agree with me? You can say it out loud. You don't? Okay, no. Don disagrees with me. Everybody else disagrees with me? That instrumental music is it's not okay?
Not in worship.
Not in worship? Why not?
Not
we have to have examples for everything that we do? Yes, so
we have to have authority.
We have to have authority for it? Okay. Well, I mean, do we have I agree that we have to have authority, but I mean, am I doing anything wrong? It doesn't say that we should have a church building or classes or a water fountain or anything like that. It does say we should meet in an upper room. It does say that we should greet each other with a holy kiss. So why don't we do those things? I completely agree, and I will do that too. I will sing songs of praise to God and sing hymns and do all those things. I'll just do it with instrumental music. I completely agree that that's what the Bible teaches. Because the Bible doesn't say I can't. You have to prove that. I don't. Bible doesn't say, and this is, by the way, this is the exact argument I got into, and I didn't have a very good answer for that. But ultimately, they're going to walk away from this conversation believing you couldn't prove they were wrong because you can't show where it wasn't authorized. Because you're on the right track with authority. Yes, Matt? So I've converted one person. We can do it with instrumental music. Psalm says it. That's the Old Testament, okay. So what is that? It's under the Old Covenant, under the Old Law? All right, but I still think under the New Law we can do it. And I believe every single one of them, and I will abide by every single one of them. I can do those things and still have instrumental music. It's just helping me out. Okay, hold on. I got somebody behind you. How do you know that? I mean, the Bible doesn't teach it, so how can you prove that I have to prove it? Well, that's what you say. I mean, how do I know that? Okay, Matthew 28, 18 through 20. Build your argument, Graham. You brought it up. I'm just, you're part of this conversation. Okay. Okay. Matthew 15. These aren't in my notes, so you keep going. I've got a different approach to this. Matthew 15. I'll take that back. That's in my notes too. For later on. All right, so you need to be able to find authority. And Elizabeth, you brought this up. You need to be able to find authority for what you do. And my argument, the person said, I don't have to find authority. You have to find authority. And you're going to get to a point where you're not going to be dealing with somebody who wants to have a rational conversation. And so I had gone a different route in trying to show that this wasn't authorized. Some of what y'all have already brought up. Melissa, what was the argument you brought up when I kind of cajoled you into arguing with me today?
Well, I talked about Moses and how God specifically said, they would carry the ark a certain way, and they punished. God specified this is how it would be done. So that would be an invitation, obviously.
So a lot of people use First Chronicles 13 and First Chronicles 15, where David's moving the ark. They move it on a new cart. It wasn't pleasing to God. He moved it on a new cart. The angel of the Lord burned because they were carrying the ark that way. It wound up striking Uzzah dead. And in chapter 15 it says that the Levites were supposed to carry it, and because they didn't seek him, as Moses had commanded according to the word of the Lord. And so that was the argument I used. They said, well, but I'm doing the exact same thing. I'm doing what the Lord authorized. I'm just adding to it. Would you say, Mike? They did. Matt, did you have your hand up?
Thank you.
oh, it's, you know, saying that we can use instrumental music is different. You're saying that's different than what was.
I'm with you there.
Yes, Jamie. And I completely agree. In dealing with the person that I dealt with, and it was very sad because this person grew up in the, what you're going to say, I'm going to say the church. And he grew up in a local work, preacher's grandson. And he's gone over here. What he doesn't realize, and what we don't find a lot anymore, or people don't hold dear to this idea of what's preached in and out every Sunday, is authority. This idea of authority. Where do we get the authority for what we do? And it's important that we understand that. You know, where do we get the authority for what we do? That's where I messed up, because I tried to show, you know, what was, how it was authorized, but what a step further, which I liked, and I have in my notes Matthew 15, the idea that adding to, it's not just taking away from, but adding to, there are examples in the Bible where you, if you add to, it was considered wrong. I want to look at, though, also back in Exodus 25 real quick. We talk about authorized and not, kind of understanding the thought process of God, what He laid out for us. And then moving, you know, then we have these examples here. And that's, it's understood then as much as it's understood now. But in Exodus 25, this is talking about the tabernacle. But in Exodus 25:40, first in verse 9, it says, according to all that I'm going to show you as the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all this, of its furniture, just so you shall construct it. Verse 40, it says, see that you make them after the pattern for them which is was shown to you on the mountain. You continue on in 26:30, 27:8, 39:32, also in 42, verses 42 and 43. All those are a part of that, but it talks about holding to this pattern. Are we given a pattern of what we should do? It was on the tabernacle. Now let's talk about, you know, God laid forth a pattern for the tabernacle. What about the law, His commandments? Look over at Deuteronomy 4. If y'all were in the United Kingdom class, this is beating a dead horse, but this is a verse 2 that we can look at. Deuteronomy 4, starting in verse 1. Now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and the judgments which I am teaching you to perform, so that you may live and go in and take possession of the land which the Lord, the God of your fathers, is giving you. You shall not add to the word which I am commanding you, nor take away from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God which I command you. Here he has, when he is establishing his own law, he's talking about his commands, his judgments, his ordinances. He tells them not to add to or to take away from. He says he wants them to do exactly what he's told them to do. So here you see the idea that God established the pattern for the tabernacle and expected them to follow it. And here we see that He doesn't want you to add to or take away from. When you add on top of that the idea that you had Uzzah, and you see that David understands that we didn't do this thing in the way that God had intended for us to do. We see that we weren't authorized to. Now the argument may be that, well, you know, that's the God of the Old Testament. The God of the Old Testament is one of judgment and anger and rules with an iron fist. The God of the New Testament is one of love. They're not the same God. You know, so God expects this over here, but He doesn't expect that over there. If you look over at Hebrews 7, God's the same God from the Old Testament and the New Testament. We know that Acts 3:13 talks about He is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They understood it. But this premise was understood in the Old Testament and in the New. The Hebrew writer writes in verse 12, for when the priesthood is changed, of necessity there takes place a change of the law also. This is speaking of Christ becoming the high priest. For the one concerning whom these things are spoken belongs to another tribe. Christ wasn't a part of the Levitical tribe. That's who had to be the high priest, somebody of the Levitical tribe. It says, from which no one has officiated at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord was descended from Judah, a tribe with reference to which Moses spoke nothing concerning the priest. So he says, if we're going to have a change of the high priest, there must be a change in the law. All right, and so it's understood that the law specified something and that it shouldn't be deviated beyond. That, you know, just because it specified a Levitical high priest, that we could have one from Judah or from Reuben or from something else. We can see that here in the New Testament. Then you look at Matthew 15. They went beyond what God had told them when it came to acts of worship. So when dealing with this, we can show that there is a pattern, and we can show that, you know, God doesn't want us to add to or take away from, that we need to have authority for what we do. Yes, Matt? Yeah, we don't see any sort of authority for it. Yes, sir. Well, and I agree. The problem that you're gonna run into and deal with, and this is what I dealt with, and I hit an impasse with the person, at least for a time, is the fact that they didn't have a concept of authority. And so I took this from the standpoint of, this is the arguments that they said. The Bible doesn't say anything about it, then I can do it. And that was kind of the approach they took. Takeaway is that we need to be careful and be thinking about understanding how we authorize what we do. And I use the idea of Bible classes or song books, water fountains, the church building. You know, how do we authorize those things? Can you defend why we have those things? We use the collective funds for those things. How do we get authority for what we do? It's important because those questions will come up. Authority, I think, is very underrated when it comes to dealing with other Christians and them understanding why we do what we do. Sometimes you just kind of take it for granted. And so, yes, generic and specific authority is something we need to really be thinking about. I actually think it's coming up on our schedule. Yes, sir.
God, the whole idea that Moses researches, trying to find out what the mind of God was,
put that one in your back pocket, because I didn't have that in my back pocket to be able to talk to this person about. I just, you know, some of this is being able to think on your feet, and it doesn't mean you can't articulate a thought. Sometimes it's just you need the thought to come to you. So this is good practice for that, and I completely agree. Like I said, we can all have this conversation. Let's be prepared for that. But you know, I was just thinking about the authority aspect of this because not a lot of people understand that. All right. I don't think we'll finish this last one, but we'll go ahead and start it. Moving on to topic number 3. So my premise is that too much emphasis is placed on knowledge during the elder selection process, and study or study habits should not be considered. And so we have qualifications listed in Timothy and Titus. All right? You know, we have all these qualifications we need to consider, and I don't even see knowledge as one of them in there. And so, you know, I think that when we look at it, we need to look at everything as a whole, treat it equally, and sometimes that gets overblown. Agree or disagree? This is a little bit more subjective, but there's a purpose behind it. Completely agree.
And I'll also begin that Acts chapter 20 is the work qualification of elders. And so I personally would limit 1 Timothy 3 or Titus 1 as the only qualification, those character qualifications, as he talks about the kind of man he's going to be in verse 5 and 6, or verse 6, Titus 1. But in Acts 20, Paul covers the work that he's going to be doing. They're going to have to be watchful. They're going to have to be able to know the whole counsel of God and the mission. So they have to have an outer space from which to work on. It comes from a misunderstanding of what elders do, because the elders are often thought of as decision makers and decision makers alone, instead of being spiritual leaders to help people in a spiritual nature.
I may be wrong, Coy. I think we may finish sooner. You jumped down all the way to the bottom of my notes already. It's like you've been studying this. The argument that I think sometimes are made, and I'll give you an understanding as to why I brought this up here in a second, but a lot of times, you know, hey, no, knowledge is nowhere listed in the qualifications. Coy's definitely brought out that they are. You look at, you know, it says able to teach. Well, I know, and I'm getting to that. You wait, I'm getting to that. But it says here, able to teach. So able to teach. Why, you know, the argument would be, well, that's ability. That's not, you know, actually being, is a ability to impart versus knowledge. Not a new convert. Well, I'm not a new convert. I've been a Christian, let's see, I've been a Christian for 25 years. So I'm not a novice. So I'm knowledgeable enough. Yes, ma'am. I know stuff. I know that, let's see, I got it in my notes. Hold on. I know what I know. let's see here. I mean, I read my Bible. I can explain to you, what I believe on the five forms of worship. You know, I can tell you about the experiences I've had. I've been a Christian for over 25 years. You know, I can tell you about what you should look out for, drinking and drugs and language and pornography and gambling and divorce and adultery. I can impart all that knowledge to you. So I know stuff. I mean, but it's a matter of, you know, I think that sometimes we take it to the nth degree. So I'm not a new convert. I've been a Christian for 25 years and I know stuff. I mean, I hold fast to the faithful word. And I mean, obviously I can teach, I can refute. I'm up here trying to argue with y'all. And I'm not talking about me, like, imagine me being 55. I'm definitely not qualified. But from the standpoint of what I'm doing, so that would be my argument. I mean, so I have knowledge and I have, yes, sir.
Might know, me was applied in there. If I'm shepherding the flock, I
and the qualifications that they have and the knowledge that they've learned has to translate into a growing business. The shepherd of a flock is just about knowing stuff, but how to apply that stuff, how to help people through these difficult situations. We can read through a list like we're talking about. We're having this conversation with this person about being baptized, and I can read through a list that the important try. If I know it and have wisdom because I've dealt with it for so long, then I can actually shepherd them through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that applied wisdom that, you know, I think our elders should have. And that comes from knowledge and then using and applying that knowledge over the years.
So one of the, I agree, Brandon. One of the things about this premise is it's going to be somewhat subjective. All right. When you talk about this premise that too much emphasis is placed on the knowledge during the eligibility selection process, that's my take on it. Is knowledge supposed to be something that we need to be looking at? Yes. Study habits is something we should be looking at? Yes. It's somewhat subjective. Just like Don said, well, you don't know what you know. I don't have the knowledge. If I don't know the word, but I might know some of the word. You know, there's a subjectiveness to it. But I go back to what Brandon and Coy both brought out. Is what's the work of an elder? If we look at it from the standpoint of what the work of an elder is, what they should be doing to be shepherding the flock. Acts 20 is a great place to go where it talks about the shepherd the flock of God, which he purchased with his own blood. Be on guard for yourselves. You know, this is the purpose of an eldership. We'll see, look at a couple of the verses, but be on guard for yourself and for the flock. Why? Savage wolves will come in among you, and from even among your own selves men will arise. Okay, so when we look at that, and then we look at the qualifications, you think about what an elder is going to have to do for a local work, and maybe it gives you a better grasp of the knowledge that they should have. Now, this is one of the things that pops up for me because I'm 37. And regardless of whether, you know, I don't know what will happen the next 10, 15 years, but there's going to come a time where I'll have to make a choice whether I think I am or am not qualified, if I desire the work or not. But one thing's for sure right now, as we've gone through these first two, and as I deal with these different things that kind of brought on this study, is I realize I'm deficient in certain things. What is an elder to do? I need to be up here, be able to get up here and to be able to defend what I believe on instrumental music, or what I don't believe on instrumental music, to be able to defend, you know, my position on marriage, divorce, remarriage, and not just I can sit down and respond 2 or 3 weeks later, but if somebody gets up in the pulpit, that elder, if they teach something that is wrong, they need to be able to refute the error that's taught. You know, this is the responsibility of an elder, to shepherd the flock, to guard against. I have a note here for 1 Peter 5. It says, there's a shepherd of the flock among you, exercising oversight according to the will of God, with eagerness, proving to be examples to the flock. When we talk about knowledge, I focus this on knowledge and study habits. You know, an elder needs to have knowledge, and that how much knowledge is subjective, but it's the idea that this is the work that they're to be doing. You know, how knowledgeable should they be? They need to be able to defend against the what could be coming in to tear them apart. I look at I think about what Paul wrote to Timothy, and let's see here, in 2 Timothy 3 and 4. The end of 3, it talks about, well, let's flip over to 2 Timothy. I can't quote it. 2 Timothy 3. 16, it says, all scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, so that the man of God may be equipped, be adequate, equipped for every good work. So when we think about Acts 20 and what those Ephesian elders were going to be facing. You know, the idea that they needed to be able to guard against what is going to come in amongst not only the congregation, but specifically amongst the eldership. You know, knowledge is important to be able to refute what's going to be taught. They were dealing with Gnosticism. They were dealing with idolatry. They were dealing with a bunch of different things. How they need to be able to deal with and refute those things. You know, like Coy said, Paul gave an outline of what they should be doing based on his example as a preacher. Here's what I did while I was with you. Now here's your responsibility to follow that outline specific to the local work that you're dealing with, specific to these members here who you are overseers of. Goes on in verse chapter 4, verse 1. This is Paul talking to Timothy. He says, I solemnly charge you in the presence of God and of Christ Jesus, who is to judge the living and the dead by his appearing in his kingdom. Preach the word. Be ready in season and out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with great patience and instruction. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate for themselves teachers in accordance to their own desires. And they will turn away their ears from the truth and will turn aside to myths. This is Paul writing to a preacher, but an eldership would have to deal with those same things. Should an elder not be standing there beside that preacher helping to guard the flock? To be an example. To be an example of how to stand against or to teach, you know, to guard their hearts and their souls against. You know, I think about, you know, study habits. You know, knowledge is an important thing, but as you look at what an elder is supposed to do, you know, if I'm going to be an elder one day, if I choose that role, and I'm not, I mean, that's something that would be a conversation between me and my wife, depending on where we are at that point in time in my life. I mean, I need to be thinking about these things now, because I need to be growing now. So I realize that I'm deficient now, but I'm obviously too young and not qualified in certain areas. But men who desire that work, you think you desire it now or you may desire it in the future, what are you doing now? Yes, sir. And I completely agree. I'll flip it from the other side of things. Jamie's right. From the standpoint of we should continue to keep studying, the flip side of that is you're never going to know everything. All right. So I don't want to take it to the nth degree from the idea of knowledge from the standpoint of you got to know everything. Because there will be men who think they aren't qualified because they don't know everything. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying what Jamie's talking about. The idea that you want to continually study because you're never going to know. You're always going to come up with, you know, something a little twist different on marriage, divorce, remarriage, or instrument music or something like that. These things will continue to come around. Keeping your mind fresh when you're dealing with these issues. You know, we dealt with during COVID this idea of not assembling in the building or taking the Lord's Supper outside of the assembly. That's something that hadn't been dealt with in a long time. Where do I stand on that? I need to refresh my mind. We talk about having to take the Lord's Supper, but does location, does people, does that affect my, you know, ability or my wants or need or my relationship with God to do it in the building versus out of the building. We should continually grow in that manner, those men who either desire the work or who are in that position. I think about that from us, from the men who may want that one day, but also think about it from the congregation. Because it'll be the congregation who makes the decision who is going to lead them. You know, from the standpoint of the men who are here now and the men who may come. You know, we should be trying to prep ourselves, but the congregation should be encouraging these men as well. Now, we have two elders who are 79. And so, Lord willing, we may have 10 or 15 more years of service with them. And that's just the nature of things. And then we'll have three elders. And, you know, Doug may move to Branson. I don't know what will happen. So, you know, that may, Sandy may decide, y'all got grandkids. We talked about that. Y'all got grandkids. So, but the idea is that, you know, there's going to come a time where, by nature, generations come and go, men step up. Okay, what are we doing, us as men, and then what are you and I as a congregation doing to support this idea of growing in knowledge, you know, growing and sustaining these study habits, when specifically when it comes to this sort of thing. You're never going to know anything, but if you're going to have someone who's going to shepherd you, to be an overseer of you, don't you want them to continually study, to be willing to admit that they don't know everything, be willing to listen to your point of view, study it further if that's what need be happen, but also to be able to get up and to refute something that's said from the pulpit that is error, or be able to deal with a situation that comes up in a congregation. Those things are important when you take into account the knowledge aspect or the study habits aspect of elder qualifications. Yes, sir? Yes, sir. It's been told to me from an elder, but you know, the idea that you know you are going to be judged for the work that you do. All right? Are you going to be able to stand before God and say, "I did all that I could do. I was willing to endure the sleepless nights. I was going to be willing to endure the persecution of those who came after me. Am I willing to do what Paul did for night and day for 3 years, teach, exhort? You know, do those things. Am I willing to put in the time and effort, or am I going to rest on my laurels because the congregation seems to be going fine. Everything seems to be going smooth. What are you thinking for as far as moving forward in a congregation, raising, you know, another generation? We have new converts constantly coming in. There's ever-changing faces. And that's something to think about when it comes to the knowledge base of an elder and the study habits of an elder. Now, we're right at 6 o'clock, so I'm going to leave that there, ask the elders have anything else to say specific to that topic. Yes, no? I mean, I'm not saying you are overappreciated or underappreciated. I mean, this just happened to be the last topic of the day, but, you know. But it's something to think about. I think about it from the perspective of me or Josh or Mike or Neil or any of these other young men who are young, we're middle-aged. But I think about it from that standpoint, moving up. We need to be prepared. We need to be thinking about those things now. And then as to the congregation as we move forward. All right, that'll be it. Yes, sir. I completely agree. Y'all didn't have any idea what I was going to say other than the topic. I completely agree. It's not, you think about it, we talk about it, we've had forums before, but that is a foreign concept to a lot of different congregations, to be able to get up and to talk about a controversial topic, or to get up and we actually argued and debated a little bit tonight. I know, right? I mean, that's something that we did. And you know what? I think we're better for it if we're all striving to know the truth. And the eldership is okay with that. And I think that's what, you know, that is an important thing for us to all have a good attitude, strive for the truth. And I appreciate the opportunity. We've got one more topic, but I'm teaching class a couple weeks from now, so y'all get it then. And y'all already got it, so y'all should be ready for attendance, right? So, all right. At this time, Wayne, if you don't mind leading your last song, and then Rocky, if you mind leading us in our closing prayer.